From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the everyday habits and tastes of a tyrant. We talk with journalist Mark Bowden about Saddam Hussein. Bowden interviewed Iraqi exiles who once worked closely with Saddam Hussein to find out what the Iraqi leader reads, eats, watches, and what makes him vulnerable. Bowden's article, Tales of the Tyrant, is the cover story of the Atlantic Monthly's May edition. Bowden is also the author of Black Hawk Down. Also today, being brown in America and where that fits in the ongoing dialogue between black and white. We talk with Richard Rodriguez about his new book, Brown. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording of the Vienna Philharmonic conducted by Seiji Ozawa. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush says he's sending Secretary of State Colin Powell to the Middle East in an effort to mediate a ceasefire between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The president called on Israel to stop its military operation in the West Bank and to withdraw its troops from Palestinian-controlled lands. He also said that Israel should stop building Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. At the same time, the president criticized Yasser Arafat, saying the Palestinian leader is largely responsible for his current problems. Israeli troops have Arafat trapped in what remains of his headquarters compound in Ramallah. Though both Palestinians and Israelis came in for criticism in President Bush's speech, both sides saw a reason for hope in the call for an end to violence. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The president said the current dire situation is largely of Yasser Arafat's making. Mr. Bush said Arafat had betrayed the hopes of the people he's supposed to lead and must immediately stop the terror attacks. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat wondered how Arafat could stop anything while a prisoner in Ramallah with his security forces devastated. President Bush also offered unusually blunt criticism of some Israeli policies. He said settlement activity must stop, the army must withdraw from Palestinian areas it's occupied, and show more respect for the dignity of the Palestinians. After a meeting with U.S. Envoy Anthony Zinni, Sharon said the military operation will continue and no political negotiations could occur until terrorism ends. In the first crack in Israel's isolation of Arafat, Sharon said Zinni will be permitted to meet with the Palestinian leader. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
One of the men detained at Guantanamo Navy Base in Cuba may soon be sent to the United States to face charges. U.S. officials say they believe 22-year-old Yasser Issam Hamdi was born in the United States and therefore cannot be tried in a military tribunal. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
Yasser Issam Hamdi is one of the foreigners who fought with the Taliban in Afghanistan. He was captured in December outside the city of Mazar-e Sharif during the same operation in which the American John Walker Lind was detained. Lind is now in jail in Northern Virginia, charged with conspiring to kill U.S. citizens abroad. Hamdi could soon be in a similar situation. He's told his captors in Guantanamo that he was born in Louisiana, and U.S. officials say his story checks out. Pentagon spokeswoman Victoria Clark says U.S. officials think Hamdi is therefore a U.S. citizen entitled to constitutional rights. President Bush has already said no U.S. citizen will be tried in one of the special military commissions being organized to try alleged terrorists. Clark says the Pentagon and the Justice Department are trying to determine what to do next with Hamdi. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 36 points to close at 10,235 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite gained 5 points. It closed at 1,789. The S&P 500 gained a point. This is NPR News. Federal regulators have cleared the way for the marketing of a computer chip that can be implanted under the skin. The chip contains medical records. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
The chip is about the size of a grain of rice. It transmits data by radio waves to an external scanner. The idea is that emergency medical workers could identify someone who was unconscious or unable to speak and get immediate access to a patient's entire medical history. The FDA told the chip's manufacturer, Applied Digital Solutions, that the agency doesn't consider the chip a medical device. That clears the way for marketing. The chip is expected to cost about $200. Chip readers will cost around $2,000. The company plans to give away some scanners to hospitals and ambulance companies to build a market. The device has drawn criticism from privacy advocates. They fear people's records might be read without their permission. Richard Knox, NPR News.
Native American activist Leonard Peltier has filed suit against the FBI, charging that a protest march by agents prevented him from being fairly considered for clemency or parole. Peltier has been in prison since 1975, when he was convicted in the murders of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. During the final days of his presidency, President Clinton considered whether to grant clemency to Peltier, who's always denied that he was the killer. Peltier's suit claims that FBI agents launched a campaign of misinformation and disinformation that led the president not to approve the request for clemency. The FBI said the campaign against clemency for Peltier was carried out by agents on their own time. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Bush administration is considering trying to accomplish what the Gulf War failed to do, bring down Saddam Hussein. My guest Mark Bowden has written an article about the daily life and inner world of Saddam Hussein. That article, Tales of the Tyrant, is the cover story of the May issue of The Atlantic Monthly. Mark Bowden is also the author of Black Hawk Down. His book, Killing Pablo, about Pablo Escobar, comes out in paperback next month. It won an Overseas Press Club Award for the best nonfiction book on foreign affairs. Bowden is also a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he was a reporter for 22 years. Bowden's article on Saddam Hussein is based on interviews with Iraqi exiles who once worked closely with Saddam Hussein. Let's start with Saddam's daily habits. I asked Bowden where Saddam sleeps at night and if he thinks of himself as being on the run.
I think he definitely is on the run, and it isn't just from American agents or enemies from outside his own country. He has to be on the run within his country because he has so many enemies. So he sleeps at any one of a number of secret locations. There are about 20 to 25 extremely elaborate, beautiful palaces that are ostensibly his residences. But I'm told that he rarely actually sleeps in any of them. He has homes in, nice neighborhoods here and around Baghdad for the most part, and he moves from place to place every night so that nobody, probably not even, members of his family, are aware on a given day where he's going to be that night.
And you also write that all of the palaces, all of the more than 20 palaces, prepare three meals a day for him, even though he can't be at all those palaces for each of the meals. Why do they do that?
Well, they do this elaborate pantomime as though he was there in order to obscure where, in fact, he is. I mean, if you could watch, where his chefs went every day, or you could watch, where the helicopters were taking off and landing all the time, or where the convoys of limousines were heading, you could figure out where Saddam was. So they maintain the pretense at all these palaces that he's present. So you'll see bustling, comings and goings, limousines arriving, limousines leaving, all of the food preparations going on, the helicopters coming and going as though he was there. And they do this at all of his palaces. So it's a shell game.
And what kind of food are they preparing for him that he's not going to eat at each of the palaces where he's not going to be?
I'm told it's really good food. He imports a lot of seafood and things that are harder to get in Iraq. He likes to eat well. He's got an educated palate, and he has chefs who've been trained in Europe and around the world. And they prepare really wonderful meals. And I don't know whether the staff gets to sit down and feast on it when he's not there, but it's prepared for him as though he were there. And I suspect that the people preparing it don't really know, whether he's going to be there or not. So they have to prepare it as though he was going to be.
How does his staff ensure that the food isn't poisoned?
Well, I imagine it's tasted. It's tested fairly thoroughly. What I'm told is that all of the food that's going to be prepared for Saddam is irradiated by nuclear scientists to make sure that there's no dangerous, radioactive material in it. There's no kind of, one way of tracking a person in this modern age would be to infect them or get them to eat something that has a radioactive element that could be detected or traced, and so they look for that. And it's also tested for poisons. So that's at a preliminary level, and then I presume, you know, in the kitchens, there are members of Saddam's personal bodyguards who would oversee the preparation of the food, and I suspect would, you know, taste it themselves to make sure that it hadn't been poisoned in the kitchen.
Apparently, he occasionally drinks wine, even though that's forbidden by Islam. How much wine does he drink?
I don't think, I'm told he's not a heavy drinker. He likes to have wine with his meals. He's not an oenophile. He prefers, I think, Matus Rosé, I'm told, is his favorite wine. But he just likes it with his meals. He's not a heavy drinker. In fact, it's interesting that Saddam, you know, is fairly abstemious about most things in his life. He lives, at least in terms of his personal habits, a life of moderation in how much he eats, what he drinks, his, you know, personal affairs, whatever.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Bowden. He's the author of Black Hawk Down. He has the cover story in the May edition of the Atlantic Monthly. It's about Saddam Hussein's private life, his personal life, his daily habits. And the piece is called Tales of the Tyrant. You write that Saddam Hussein has a slipped disc in his back. How long has he had that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I was told that by General Wafik Samurai, who was Saddam's chief of intelligence during the Iran-Iraq war. And so he spent over the 8-year period of that war a lot of time with Saddam almost every day. And so he was the one who told me about the back condition, the fact that his doctors have prescribed that he walk 2 hours a day. But he didn't indicate to me, nor do I think he knows exactly how he hurt himself.
And how does the slip disc affect his mobility and just his day-to-day life?
Well, he works hard to keep it under control because it's very important for Saddam not to appear to be aging or to be weak in any way. He's somebody who has a lot of enemies, and he also lives in a society that respects sort of his macho qualities and youth and vigor. And so even though he is getting older, he's like 65, 66 years old, and in various ways he's becoming weaker and infirm, he works hard to disguise that. He swims, for instance, every day to keep the back condition under control. But apparently it leaves him, the only manifestation of it is that he walks with a slight limp. And so he avoids being videotaped or filmed walking for any distance. You'll see him in tapes walking a few steps, but he avoids being seen publicly walking because he doesn't want to be seen to be limping at all.
Because it makes him look vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. It makes him look vulnerable and old. He goes to the length of having his speeches printed out on paper with just a few lines per page so that the lettering is so large that he can read it without his reading glasses. I mean, there are a few of us over the age of 45 or 50 who don't need some kind of help reading. It's just the most normal thing that could happen to a person. But for Saddam Hussein to wear reading glasses would be to suggest that he's getting old, that he may be over the hill. And so he tries to avoid giving the appearance of aging.
Now, you write about the books he reads and also the books he's written, or that at least have been ghost-written for him. Let's start by talking about the books that he's written. Give us the overview.
Well, Saddam fancies himself a writer, and he really admires statesmen like Winston Churchill, who were, you know, powerful political leaders, but who were also writers and artists. And so he has written any number of books about political theory and philosophy and history. He's written, with the help of a ghostwriter, an extensive autobiography. And he's also written three novels, which he apparently writes himself. And the reason I think that it's likely that he writes those himself is that he sends out the manuscripts of his novels to writers who he admires in Iraq, soliciting their advice about his style and plot and everything else. And I don't think he would go to those lengths if he wasn't serious about the writing himself. His novels are like romance novels, but they're set in a kind of mythical Arabian past, sort of like in the period of the Arabian Nights. And, you know, he writes about kings and peasant girls who the king falls in love with. But he also uses them as kind of little morality parables and political parables to explain why he does the things he does and how he sees himself. So in that sense, I think they're really interesting for anyone who wants to try to better understand him as a person.
Have you read the books?
No, I haven't. I don't read in Arabic, and the books have not been translated into English. So I had to settle for interviewing people who had read them.
Now, you also learned that there's a 600-page hand-lettered copy of the Quran that is said to be written with Saddam Hussein's own blood, which he donated a pint at a time over 3 years. How can you be sure that's not an apocryphal story?
Well, I think, you know, I weighed the information that I got depending on the source. Actually, that fact has been reported in the New York Times, and a number of the people who I have talked to were aware of it, of sources who I think had no reason to make up something like that. So I believe it's true. It's also sort of in keeping with Saddam, who is given to making very grand personal gestures. For instance, one of the huge statues in Baghdad, which honors the so-called victory in the Iran-Iraq War, consists of these two huge forearms and hands grasping swords rising up out of the ground. And Saddam modeled for that himself. Those are his arms and his fists. So it would be like him to do something like have a version of the Quran written up in his own blood as a demonstration of his own blood commitment to, you know, to this faith.
My guest is journalist Mark Bowden. His article about Saddam Hussein, Tales of the Tyrant, is the cover story of the Atlantic Monthly's May edition. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Mark Bowden is my guest. He wrote the cover story of the May edition of the Atlantic Monthly. It's called Tales of the Tyrant, The Private Life and Inner World of Saddam Hussein. Mark Bowden is also the author of Black Hawk Down. Another thing you wanted to know is, what are Saddam Hussein's favorite movies?
Right.
Why'd you want to know that?
Because I love movies. And, you know, it's one of the things that I find interesting in meeting and talking to anybody, what kind of books they like, what kind of movies they like. I was told that he likes films and that he reads a lot. And so one of the questions I asked of everyone was, you know, what kind of books does he read? What kind of movies does he like? And, you know, some of them weren't terribly surprising. The fact that he likes movies that deal with political intrigue, conspiracy, assassination, movies like Day of the Jackal. He likes movies that sort of portray the world as being manipulated by powerful figures behind the scenes, which suggests to me that he sort of is the kind of person who believes that you can't judge things by the surface, that nothing is as it seems. He has that kind of conspiratorial mindset. But he also likes films which, you know, like The Old Man and the Sea. That's the one that really threw me. And any number of people told me that he both liked that book and that movie. And he's, you know, I got that from like three or four different people who knew him well. So, and I found that to be really strange. I mean, that would seem to be it's not strange. I mean, it's a wonderful story and it's a great movie. But it's not in keeping with what you would predict, I guess, a dictator to be particularly fond of. It tells the story of a poor old man with nothing who, you know, wrestles against this giant fish and ultimately succeeds, but succeeds in a way that no one really knows or understands. And it's a kind of both heroic, tragic tale. I've always really liked it myself, so maybe that's why I found it so interesting.
Saddam Hussein, you say, commissioned a film about his life called The Long Days, and that it was edited by Terrence Young, who directed 3 James Bond movies?
Right. They paid him a huge amount of money, and he went to Baghdad and basically, for the money, you know, put his professional talents to work piecing together this film. And I never had a chance to see it, but I'm told it's just, you know, endless, and very few people can stand to watch it all the way through. But I wanted to actually interview Young. Unfortunately, he died late last year, I guess. I had put him down on my list of people who I definitely wanted to see, but he unfortunately died before I had a chance.
What have you been told about how the movie has been screened and who it's been screened for? Is it a theatrical release? Is it shown at ceremonies?
It is. It's shown a lot in Iraq. It's shown in schools. It's a documentary. You know, it's 6 hours long, although it's a fictionalized documentary, and they have scenes in it where actors act out parts. In fact, I think Saddam's nephew plays the young Saddam in the movie. But it's, you know, I would imagine it's probably required viewing for a lot of people in Iraq.
One of the things you wanted to find out by writing this piece about the inner life of Saddam Hussein is what drives him.
Mm-hmm.
Did you reach any conclusions?
I did, yeah. I think that, you know, there are dictators all over the world throughout history have been motivated by any number of things. Some are just venal and are motivated by, you know, trying to amass as much money as they can. Someone like, say, Idi Amin or Papa Doc in Haiti. And you have some who are just sadists, I think. You have some like Hitler or Stalin who were ideologues, who really believed that they possessed knowledge of how to create a superior state. Saddam Hussein appears to be motivated primarily by vanity, by personal vanity. He doesn't have a great deal of interest in money. He lives, as I said, a kind of abstemious existence, so he's not a hedonist. He wants to be remembered. He wants to go down in history as a great man. And, of course, the world that he inhabits is actually very provincial. Saddam hasn't traveled outside of the Arab states. I know that he's been to Egypt in his youth, but in his adulthood, he's been basically in Iraq and neighboring Arab states. He has been to conventions or conferences in Havana, I believe. But beyond that, he hasn't traveled widely. So his vision or ambition is rooted completely in that Arab culture. And so to Saddam, to be a great man means to be a powerful Arab leader, someone who 100 years from now or 500 years from now, when, as he sees it, the Arab culture will have triumphed and will be prevailing throughout the world, he will be remembered as one of the architects and one of the great men of history. So I think these are the things that motivate him.
This is the kind of thing I always wonder about dictators and tyrants. If on the one hand he wants to be remembered positively in history and he wants to be a hero because he's, you know, motivated by that type of vanity, he must know that his own people fear him and that many of them despise him,
mm-hmm.
and that many people around the world, and including in some Arab countries, despise him as well.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that feed his vanity?
Well, I think that the question betrays a kind of cultural bias. I think that, you know, one of the ways that we would define greatness in the Western world would be someone who is fondly remembered, someone who is admired for the good things that they did, for their kindness, let's say, for the broadness of their vision. You know, in Saddam's world, someone is remembered and revered for their strength and for their power. And one of the things, as he would see it, that he has to do to project that strength is he needs to be vicious. He needs to be cruel. The fact that he has enemies, and he has many powerful enemies, enhances his vision of himself, because he sees himself as a sort of a lone warrior, you know, leading his people, Iraq, against an overwhelming tide of Westernism. And, you know, the fact that he keeps the faith, that he strikes fear into his enemies, is something that I think he believes will, you know, in the long run, make him a great figure. And in fact, if you look back in history, you know, to some of the great conquerors of history, from Saladin, who, say, is a great Arab leader, I mean, they were brutal men. They you know, slayed their foes. When they defeated an enemy, they raped and pillaged and burned, and, you know, they struck fear into people who didn't follow them. So I think, you know, he sees himself more in those terms than in what our concept would be of great leadership.
The Bush administration has been trying to get international support for attacking Saddam Hussein and trying to depose him. Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense from the Iraqi exiles that you interviewed what their thoughts about that were? The people who now oppose Saddam Hussein, what would they think of American intervention?
Well, all of the people who I talked to would welcome some form of American intervention, but they disagree in dramatic ways about how they would like to see that done. Because of the nature of the people I'm interviewing, these are all exiles from Iraq. You know, they would like to see a regime change. They would like to see Saddam gone. But some of them want, for instance, the Iraqi National Congress people, like Entifad, who's the engineer, actually works with the Iraqi National Congress, would like to see a straight-out invasion of Iraq, where for the United States just to come in militarily and remove Saddam. Others, like General Samurai, feel that that would be a disaster, that Saddam would unleash weapons of mass destruction against Israel and perhaps even against other Western countries and against his own people if that happened, and would much prefer and think it would be more effective to cultivate some kind of an internal coup, to find someone within the Iraqi military who could be enlisted to step up and arrest or kill Saddam Hussein and overthrow the regime from within. So they all would like to see him gone, but they vary in their techniques.
Mark Bowden's article, Tales of the Tyrant, about Saddam Hussein, is the cover story of the Atlantic Monthly's May edition. Bowden is also the author of the book Black Hawk Down. His book Killing Pablo, about Pablo Escobar, will be published in paperback next month. We'll talk more about Saddam Hussein in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. Also by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Far Appalachia, Following the New River North by Noah Adams, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Saddam Hussein holds on to power. We continue our discussion with journalist Mark Bowden. Also, writer Richard Rodriguez tells us why he rejects the term Hispanic. His new book is called Brown. And Lord Schwartz reviews the new recording of the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Seiji Ozawa. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Mark Bowden. His article, Tales of the Tyrant, The Private Life and Inner World of Saddam Hussein, is the cover story of the Atlantic Monthly's May edition. Bowden is also the author of Black Hawk Down and Killing Pablo, about Pablo Escobar. His article on Saddam Hussein is based on interviews with Iraqi exiles who formerly worked closely with Saddam Hussein. What do you consider to be the most frightening story about Saddam Hussein that you were told?
I think the most frightening story told to me was told to me by a gentleman who didn't want me to use his name. And he had been a sort of mid-level bureaucrat in Baghdad. And soon after Saddam took power, one of the crusades that the new regime undertook was to rid the Baghdad government of corruption. And so some of the bureaucrats in this man's office were investigated or were accused of accepting bribes. And as he told me, it was probably true that some level of petty corruption did exist within mm-hmm. his department. But all of those who were accused of accepting bribes were executed. They were hung. And every member of the office, including the man I interviewed, were required to come to the prison and watch their friends one by one being marched to the scaffold and hung as a lesson to them in what would happen. And it, I mean, to me, I think some things register to me just personally. I've always had a particular horror of execution. And, you know, to imagine this scene where, you know, people who were accused of accepting a bribe, which is clearly wrong, and, you know, they should be fired or punished, would be executed for that. And that, you know, that I, as a coworker or one of them, you know, would be there, you know, to witness it. I mean, it just showed a kind of casual sadism mm-hmm. in that society that was so appalling to this man that he made a decision that he had to leave just because he refused to live in a place where something like that could happen. But I think that it illustrated to me the kind of fear that people live with on a daily basis. And more than any of the other stories I was told, that kind of made my skin crawl.
Do you feel that you understand any more now how Saddam Hussein has managed to hold on to power for over a decade since the end of the Gulf War?
I do think I understand it better. I have a much better understanding of the pervasiveness of the fear in that country and the skill with which Saddam exercises that power and makes people afraid. But he also lavishly rewards the people who are faithful to him. And, you know, he surrounds himself with his own villagers, from people from his own extended clan, so that, I mean, he can trust them, I guess, more than almost anyone else. Iraq does a very tribal society. And, you know, I think Saddam, one of the more interesting facets of the piece is this explanation that I was given by my friend Al-Bazaz, the editor in London, of the difference between what he calls tribal mentality and city or town mentality, and how Saddam typifies tribal mentality. I think that analogy, to understand what's happening in Iraq, to understand how Saddam has become as powerful as he is, has, I think, much broader implications in the world. I think those of us, for instance, in the West, fall into the category of town mentality. You know, we live in a society of laws. We believe that the ultimate good is peaceful coexistence. We believe in the need for compromise. Saddam comes from a world where what Al-Bazaz calls tribal or village mentality, where power exists for its own sake. And you don't cooperate or compromise with your enemies. You defeat them and you frighten them to the extent that they are willing to put up with your oppression. And I think that defines a sort of philosophy of power and governance that is pervasive in many parts of the world, and that's something that we here in the West, I think, don't fully understand.
As the Bush administration considers attacking Iraq or trying to overthrow Saddam Hussein, did you learn any information in the course of your research that made you think about the nature of the threat that Iraq poses to us? How grave is the threat? What type of threat is it?
I do think, after researching this piece, that Iraq poses a tremendous and immediate threat to the United States and to the rest of the world. And I didn't really think that so much before I worked on it. But there's no question in my mind that Saddam has aggressively been pursuing the development of weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons in particular, that could kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. He's also had a fairly sophisticated nuclear weapons program underway for some time. I don't think that we here in the West, or even Israel, face any real threat of being attacked directly by Iraq. But Saddam, and he's quoted throughout the piece that I wrote, talking about how his war with the United States has never ended, that he still considers himself to be at war, and he still plans to win this war. If he possesses these weapons, which I think almost every source that I find, both ones that I interviewed myself and the research that I did on this piece, are in agreement that if he does not yet have these weapons, he will in fairly short order. There's no doubt in my mind that he will get those weapons into the hands of people who will use them against us. And so I think that the kind of weapons we're talking about can really only be developed by a state, because they require basically the creation of an industry in order to make happen. And that's why Iran and Iraq and North Korea are such a threat to us right now. The only way that you can produce these kind of weapons on the scale where they would be really effective is in a state like Iraq. So the existence of organizations like Al-Qaeda, who will unhesitatingly use these weapons against us, and the existence of a state that's actively trying to manufacture those weapons, put those two things together, and I think we have a real and immediate threat to our country. And so that's why I personally think that I'm in agreement with this administration that we, in our own self-interest and self-defense, need to act very strongly and very soon to get rid of Saddam Hussein.
If we were to either assassinate or depose Saddam Hussein, do you think that that would effectively end his regime?
I think that if we got rid of Saddam Hussein, it would end his regime, without a doubt. The problem, the big question, is what would follow it. Saddam's regime is a cult of personality and a cult of family, basically. He trusts so few people, and those people who he does trust, he trusts primarily because he knows they fear him. He hasn't distributed power widely throughout Iraq. He doesn't anymore represent an ideology or a particular party. He is essentially a party of one. And if Saddam Hussein was gone, there would be a real power vacuum in Iraq. And the problem or the fear is that you would then have potentially some maniacal dictator would take over, or a civil war. You would have perhaps, the growth of the Shia movement in Iraq, where you could get, some kind of fundamentalist Islamic government there. So, in fact, I think the reason that Saddam has survived as long as he has is that there has been a real quandary about, what would come after Saddam and what that would mean for the region and for the rest of the world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about Saddam Hussein.
You're welcome. My pleasure, Terry.
Mark Bowden's article, Tales of the Tyrant, about Saddam Hussein, is the cover story of the Atlantic Monthly's May edition. Bowden is also the author of the book Black Hawk Down. His book Killing Pablo, about Pablo Escobar, will be published in paperback next month. Coming up, Richard Rodriguez talks about his new book, Brown. This is Fresh Air. My guest Richard Rodriguez has just written the third volume of his memoirs about being Mexican-American. His new book, Brown, is in part an examination of what it's like to be neither black nor white in a country that is obsessed with race. Rodriguez is a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine and the Sunday Opinion section of the LA Times. He's also an essayist for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. Rodriguez opposes the brand of multiculturalism that emphasizes the politics and literature of identity. He writes, "It's one thing to know your author, man or woman or gay or black or paraplegic or president. It's another thing to choose only man or woman or gay or black as the only voice empowered to address you." But here's the paradox. Although he takes issue with certain aspects of the literature of identity, all of his books are about being Mexican-American.
What I oppose is the relegation of literature to sociology, and that what I'm those readers who use books as a way of reducing a human life to a kind of case study or type. I describe in Brown this moment when I was doing a reading some years ago at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And I had the 6:30 slot. There was a lesbian poet who was coming on at 8 o'clock. And so there at 6:30, I had my Mexican-American readers, and God bless them, they came, postponing their dinners, to listen to the Mexican-American writer. And somewhere in the course of my reading, this young Mexican-American, who was probably impatient with my voice and with my prose, noisily got up and walked out of the auditorium. And at the moment at which he opened the back doors, I could see all the lesbians waiting in the lobby for their lesbian poet. And I thought to myself, why couldn't I get the lesbians at my reading and the lesbians take the the Mexican-Americans get the lesbian poet? Why do we always use literature in this way simply as a way of discovering ourself? Why don't we discover ourselves in the other? That's obviously been the great engagement of my life, trying to find myself in African-American literature, for example, to the point now that I cannot imagine the voice I'm using now, without having read James Baldwin. He gave me my voice.
In what way did he give you your voice?
He taught me, I remember reading Baldwin, especially Baldwin the Essayist, in the 1950s when I was a very precocious young reader. I've just been moving away from Spanish, which is my mother tongue, moving into this new language. And Baldwin had this clarity of style that also disguised and held in check his anger with such elegance that he taught me the way to use language that was fierce and hot and urgent, but do it in a way that allowed the reader to breathe. And I thought I remember watching him on Baldwin on David Susskind's TV show in the 50s. This dates me, I realize, but I remember his frog eyes as he came on the show and his cigarette and the way his eyebrows would arch at Susskind's question. And I thought to myself, this is the writer. This is what I want to be. And I found my model in him.
You talk about wanting to melt down categories so that, you know, to realize that so many people in America are made up of different groups, so it's hard to just like define yourself as one type, one ethnic group, one cultural group. I'm wondering if being gay has affected your sense of that, because, you know...
Oh, it's been a huge influence on my life. I didn't realize that really until I was writing this book, because what I recognized was that my lifelong preoccupation has been with this question of the dangerous love. The most dangerous thing about me as a boy was that I was wrongly in love. I remember there was a moment. I must have been about 9 years old. I had a very good friend, and I was frustrated by. I had a crush on him, and I was frustrated by that fact. And I remember one day throwing a hammer at him, at his face, which he deflected, but it hit him. And I remember our mothers talking that night on the telephone, and I remember my mother saying somewhere in the course of the conversation, well, boys would be boys, which is to say, boys finally get in fights. But I thought to myself, even then, you know, that if she only knew that I had a crush on my friend, the ceiling would collapse, the whole world would turn upside down, that the most dangerous thing that I could say was that I was in love with him. So that as a very young boy, not only do I begin to guard my eyes, but I also begin to focus my eyes on those exceptions. The Irish bar in 19th century New York with one solitary African-American face. Who is he? Why is he here? I want to know that question. I want to ask that question because that's what the question that I begin to ask myself. Why do I go to listen to Malcolm X? What is driving me there? Why am I the only Mexican in the crowd in 1965 listening to Malcolm X? Why am I the only Mexican in the crowd, apparently, at a British comedy that comes, a traveling show that comes through Sacramento? What is that except some kind of desire to fall in love with those things that don't inevitably belong to me?
Are there things that are supposed to define you in Mexican culture that are completely the opposite of the things that are supposed to define you in gay culture, like what it means to be a man, the sense of macho?
Yes. In Mexican culture, what it means to be a man is to have children. You may be cruel toward your wife and sentimental toward your mother, which is what Mexican men tend to be, but you also have to have children, preferably sons, who are as dreadful as you are.
I'm going to stop you. Can you get away with saying that, that you may be cruel to your wife and sentimental toward your mother?
Yes, I think you can. I did it in my second book, and no one has objected.
Uh-huh.
There is a cruelty in Mexico toward the wife that is balanced by a kind of sentimentality about mother. Mexicans are enormously sentimental about mamacita and casual about betrayals of the wife. Machismo is not a word that accidentally happens in Mexico. There's a kind of sexual license given the male that's real. My great sin in Mexico is that I'm a joto. I am a queer. But the evidence of that is that I'm dry, that I'm without children, and that I'm half a man or less because of that. And that obviously weighs on me. You know, the great drama of in my early books was that anxiety about having soft hands, that anxiety about not being manly in the way that my father was manly, that anxiety of having too many words, there is a saying in Spanish that a man should be feo, fuerte, formal, ugly, strong, and formal is almost the English word formal, but it's sober. A man should be sober, and what that means is, as I understood it, is that you're not chatty. And I was chatty. I was like a woman as a boy. I had too many words. They were spilling out of my mouth. Whereas my father was always formal. My father, whenever people were in need, whenever there was emergency, my father was always there, but always silent. And I never had that. I had too many words.
In your book, you make the point that although you are often described as Hispanic, you're not really sure that Hispanic is something that really exists. There's no Hispanics in Mexico or Argentina or Chile. What do you mean?
I mean that Richard Nixon's administration created that category in the 1970s. They created the category of the Asian, and that in many ways it's an absurd notion. But it comes into a country that has always been in its deepest obsessed with blood and race. So now most of your listeners probably think that Hispanics constitute some new third race in America, that there is now some brown race called Hispanics. Well, I want to tell your listeners that we do not exist as a racial group, that you are wrong about us. We are an ethnic group. We believe that we belong to a culture. By asserting one's Hispanicity, one is related to religion, to language, to food, to recipes, to weather. When my mother watches Univision or Telemundo, the Spanish language television networks, she'll watch a program, say a discussion show, and she will see the audience, and there will be blonde women, peroxided or not. There will be black men. There will be brown people like us. And she doesn't say, oh, they're of different races. She says, son todos Latinos, by which she means we are united by the culture, by the language we are speaking, Español. That's the culture. When Americans look at an audience, and Jerry Springer, comparable audience, they say, oh, there's a black girl in the audience, and there's a white girl sitting next to her, and there's an Asian girl sitting next to her. They're making an assertion about blood. The Hispanic claim is a claim about ghosts. It's about culture. It's about spirits. It's about tradition. It is about all the ways we remember ourselves as created by the past, not simply blood, but in some larger sense, ghostly, because all the things we carry with us from the past, the most powerful things, are the hauntings that the past brings into our lives, the reminders of grandmothers long dead.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Richard Rodriguez is the author of the new book, Brown. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD featuring the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Seiji Ozawa. This is Fresh Air. Tonight begins the last series of concerts of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Seiji Ozawa, who is leaving for Vienna. His first recording with his new orchestra, the Vienna Philharmonic, is an album of Viennese music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Critics don't often get asked to rehearsals, and probably for good reason. Once, nearly 20 years ago, Seiji Ozawa was rehearsing Alban Berg's violin concerto with violinist Itzhak Perlman, and the press was invited. But it was embarrassing. Perlman kept leaning forward to explain to Ozawa some musical detail. One time, he pointed his bow at the musician sitting behind him and informed Ozawa that they were playing a waltz. "Oh, a waltz," Ozawa exclaimed in surprise. After his 29th season as the BSO's music director, Ozawa is leaving Boston for the waltz capital of the world, Vienna. This past New Year's Day, he conducted the famous annual concert with the Vienna Philharmonic, a Viennese tradition since 1959, a concert made up mainly of waltzes. Probably a billion people around the world watched it on television. The question still is, can Seiji Ozawa conduct a waltz? It's a little hard to tell. The Vienna Philharmonic can probably play waltzes in its sleep. It's recorded waltzes with the great Viennese conductors at least since the 1930s, long before the annual New Year's concert became a tradition. One of the best waltz recordings ever made was its 1989 New Year's concert led by Carlos Kleiber, the son of yet another great Viennese conductor, Erich Kleiber. Now you can watch that concert on DVD. I thought it might be interesting to compare the two performances. Here's Ozawa conducting one of my favorite waltzes, the tenderly nostalgic Artist's Life. Now listen to Carlos Kleiber. Same orchestra, same waltz. Waltzes are really about the illusion of floating. There's a lilt, a lift, an airiness in the Kleiber performance that's missing in Ozawa's. On the telecast, Ozawa seemed to be working very hard at the umpapas. He dipped and lunged, but the music itself remained on the ground. Looking at Kleiber on the DVD, you see someone completely at ease, someone who loves this music more than he likes putting on a show. He creates an atmosphere and transfers his visible affection for the music to the players. Listen to Ozawa conduct the whirring little Dragonfly polka by Joseph Strauss, the waltz king Johann Strauss's younger brother. This is perfectly respectable, but under Carlos Kleiber, the music of Darting Wings is subtler, the shifting accents more delicately teasing, the sound of the strings more magical in its iridescence. It seems to matter more. Carlos Kleiber didn't make a lot of recordings, but some of his best consist of Viennese music. Two more are on DVD, Johann Strauss's enchanting operetta, Die Fledermaus, and the beloved opera by Richard Strauss, no relation to Johann, Der Rosenkavalier, which has a touching performance by British soprano Felicity Lott in the central role. But in both, the real stars are the orchestra and the conductor.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers today are Joyce Lieberman and Al Banks. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips, available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Well, the next Fresh Air, songwriter, singer, and guitarist Steve Earle. His new CD collects his underexposed and previously unreleased recordings. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I was fresh out of the service. It was back in 82. And I raised some cane when I come back to